There is a secret that most pro athletes, elite CEOs, and high performers all know. They all have a group of world-class coaches working for them to help them optimize their potential. At Super Athlete Radio, our goal is to provide you with the caliber of world-class coaches and guests to help you unlock your potential, dominate your industry, and dominate your life. Let's get
and really excited to bring on physical therapist and sports scientist for basketball at the University of Miami, Tommy Otley, to Super Athlete Radio today. Tommy, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chase. Thanks for having me. It's awesome to be here with you. Excited to get a chance to chat.
I'm really excited. And we were just talking, I forgot, but Eric, who you work with, who we had on a few weeks ago, that Tiger Tech technology is amazing. I know you're not using it specifically for basketball because they're not allowed to wear them on their arm when they compete in the ACC. But could you talk a little bit about what you noticed about that and the ability to recognize internal load of what's going on in our body, which I think is wild.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's done some great stuff over there with Tiger Tech, and they've been able to build it into their culture too as a team. So what they do is the guys wear it on their arm. It's a little bit, little heart rate type sensor, has the EKG, some ability to take HRV, their heart rate. And what they use it for is for in meetings, they'll check if guys are stressed by elevation in their HRV, if that guy's depressed or changes in that, they're able to detect. Start over a little bit. But they use it in their meetings. They're able to see if guys are getting a little bit more stressed when they're watching plays and really kind of hone in their approach on how this guy needs to learn and how he's going to take in information and act on it. So change, whether it's written information they're going to give that guy, is he going to watch film instead of read it in his playbook, or what is the best approach for getting that information to him that's a way that he can adapt it, isn't going to get stressed in the learning process from it. And they're also able to use it when they're traveling, when they're on the road and the guys are driving to the game. Are those guys getting stressed, and is there a way to kind of intervene on their approach to help them have the best opportunity success when they get to the field?
I think that's so wild. And then do you know what specifically they're looking at? They're looking at heart rate?
Yeah, heart rate variability is one of their big things. And so they look at that a couple of different ways, but the sensor itself is a really more reliable way of looking at that. You know, you have your Whoop bands and Oura Rings. Those are using PPG sensors, so it's just light through the skin. Theirs uses the EKG leads as well, so it's actually electrical conductivity that's given some information on it as well. So pretty awesome technology used by the Department of Defense, and Miami football is kind of like the two big only people using it right now.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting to see 10, 15, 20 years ago where that could go.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Learning and not only on the human physical performance side, but also on the tactical performance side. How are these guys gaining information? How are they understanding it and processing it and able to collect? You know, it's hard to collect information on how we respond to things. It's easy to record outputs. So how high you jump, how fast you run, those are easy things, but how your body's physically responding to it is a lot harder in a whole different area. That's kind of that internal load area, our systemic response, our physiological response to things, a lot more challenging to collect information on than the outputs or the external workload that we do.
And then in terms of whether or not I am processing this information well and clearly, they're looking at HRV. So if HRV is dropping, then potentially they're not learning well.
That's my understanding. We don't use it again with basketball, so I don't want to overspeak for how Eric's doing stuff. So like if it's a high heart rate variability, right, demonstrates some balance between the autonomic nervous system, right? So you have your fight or flight response, right? And then you have more of the rest or just digest response, right? And so that balance and interplay back and forth is that higher heart rate variability. It's the difference between beats, not your heart rate, but your heart rate variability. So having that change it shows a good balance between the rest and digest and then the fight or flight response, right? So if you have a someone who is kind of always in that high environment, that can burn on them, right? Like you guys get guys that get burned out and stuff, right? So then they can get stuck and you have a lot less variability in terms of those beat-to-beat transitions in the heart rate.
That's awesome. Well, you passed the quiz, even though you're not working with them.
Yeah, right.
So now we're going to get officially started on the podcast.
Let's go.
We have shots.
No joke, ginger.
We're going to get you fucked up, Tommy. Cheers. Welcome to Super Athlete Radio. Health, wealth, love, and happiness.
Let's go.
No joke. Ginger. Okay, and you were at Duke before you came to Miami.
I was, yeah.
Coach K's last year.
Amazing.
Is there anything that stood out to you in terms of how that program was run that made it so special with him there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, legendary coach and a great staff that surrounded them. And Duke does a great job of building a culture, right? And so having their culture and their values that they hold tightly to, I think Coach K, one, does a great job or did a great job of emulating that, right, to his players and to his staff. Two, I think there's a high expectation of everyone to uphold them, right? Mm. And I think as you have a culture of success, not that it's easier to maintain it, but you have history to draw on, right? You have guys that are constantly coming around the program, people who have gone on to the next steps into the league, right, that are coming back daily, and you see them around, right? I think all of that helps builds that culture of success. And then you have a couple key pieces of people that are surrounding that team really well, too, from like the health and human performance side, too. So you have Nick Potter with the rehabilitation and sports science side as the director of high performance. You have the strength and conditioning staff, which is phenomenal. You have dietitians. You have kind of everybody surrounding that team to help kind of keep those guys at the top of their game and playing really well.
And then what's something that someone from the outside looking in might not know about big time college basketball in terms of the impact that has on players physically and mentally?
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes behind the curtain, you don't really know what's back there, right? So with Duke basketball, it was really awesome to be able to see how those guys are taken care of, right? It's a constant process of getting information, getting feedback on how they're feeling, understanding not only what went into training yesterday, but what should we do in training tomorrow, right? How should it change? How should it modulate on how guys are responding to it? And then their consistent pieces of a good strength and conditioning program that's foundational to the guys' unique needs and having kind of spin-off pieces for guys that need a little bit of different work too.
So it sounds like there's a consistent feedback loop.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, their data capture is a big piece of that, and it's something we've tried to build as well here at University of Miami.
And then what are you using now at the University of Miami in terms of data?
Yeah, so we use a wearable, a couple different pieces. We try to capture information on the workload and training volume that we're doing, so that's kind of one piece that we collect information on, both in the weight room and on court. On court, we use Kinexon. It's a little wearable IMU sensor, detects changes of direction, how fast you run, how many times you jump, all that information, distance cover. And that gives us a good idea of what our practices look like, how hard they are, and how we can give information to coaches in terms of programming and how we want to plan for the season. Go ahead.
Yeah, real quick on that.
Yeah.
Specifically with jumping, is there a direct translation of like the more jumps, then the more wear and tear it's going to have on the body, or is it different with different players?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we try to gauge our jumps in terms of what they are, right? There's a big difference, and I think most people would agree, the big difference between just sitting there taking a couple little bitty jumpers, right, and guys dunking all day, right? So we try to gauge and split those jumps into very high and high volume jumps or high intensity jumps. Those are based on their max jump height, and jumps that are just low, right? That doesn't mean low jumps aren't sometimes a cumulatively problem thing as well. So we'll look at that as well too and see like guys who have had a history of tendonitis, guys who have tendonitis actively, what are we doing in terms of their workload to one in the weight room and in rehabilitation, build up their tendon, build up their strength so that they have more capacity and bring the floor up, right? Mm-hmm. And then two, keep an eye on the ceiling when they're reaching those higher peaks and see if we can adjust or pull things that they don't necessarily need to be doing at that moment.
And I'm guessing how they land has an impact on that as well too, right?
Yeah. It can for sure. I know everybody's different. Basketball is a unique environment. And I know like similar to Eric's, you don't want to mess guys up that are really, really good at what they're doing too. Mm. But we'll look at some of our other pieces, our performance profiling. And so we'll do one thorough assessment in the weight room of what they look like. What are their capabilities? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? What's their balance? Two, we'll use force plates to determine a couple of different things. One, their jumping capabilities, and then their max strength and their quickness too. And from that, we get a good good idea of what we want to work on with them. Are they a good breaker? Do they need to work on their breaking ability, their ability to stop quickly? Is there a big asymmetry, a guy who's coming off an injury or came into us or a girl has come into us with an injury? Is there something we need to address before we get into things that could help them down the road have better success and less likelihood of that kind of popping up as an issue again?
And then what specific muscles are potentially getting overworked from playing basketball all day? Because, again, a lot of people, there's a lot of adults who play basketball competitively, and then that's like the only thing they do. So they're not lifting weights or anything like that. And then there's a lot of kids who are super active playing basketball all day, every day, but they're not, you know, basketball in the weight room is not.
Sometimes they're a combative thing, right? Even at this level, right? So I think the big important thing is it's not supplementary. It's a big part of what we do, right? And basketball season is a war of attrition. You know, you start the season strong and you're going to get smaller. You're going to get lighter as the season goes on. And so when we're planning for the season over the summer, we're working on a real balanced program with the strength and conditioning staff, but then to try to highlight areas where somebody might have a deficit, right? If their propulsive ability is lower than their cohort of other guards that they need to, that they're surrounded by, or just compared to them in the past, that's something we need to address before we get into the whole season coming around. If they can't push off like they used to, if they're not as quick as they used to be, those are all pieces that are important. So we take a whole kind of holistic look at them. But from a standpoint of which muscle groups, like basketball is a very multi-directional thing. You're using a little bit of everything. But having a good base of strength with your typical movements really helps initially lay that groundwork. So as you're working, maybe a high school athlete or something, get good at lifts early, right? Build a good strength base. And as you get into the college world, you're going to do a lot better as you get into that. Now, when you get into the college world and even in that, it's a multi-planar movement. It's not just your forward and backward movements, right? So looking into multi-directional movements, movement proficiency, and ability to move in multiple planes is really important too. With our strength coach, we try to mimic basketball movements. Now, not every strength exercise needs to mimic basketball movements, but it's really nice to be able to build in some volumetric training and some strength base. Working into a movement that looks like a crossover, right? Or something that kind of puts them in the positions where they're going to be loaded and have high forces.
And what would that look like?
Yeah, so we'll work a lot of multi-planar lunge work. That's what our in a lot of movements that you would think like, oh, that looks just like what a basketball move would be. Or we even look like pull up tape and show the guy, hey, you move in this plane and position all the time. This is a position we're loading you in, right? And so our strength coach, Brandon Kuhn, with men's basketball, does a phenomenal job at that and kind of planning that and piecing that all together.
And then what do you feel like is the number one exercise strategy for just keeping a guy in front of you on man-to-man defense?
Great question. Yeah, I think that's the key, right? Like, so from a defensive standpoint, being able to do that is extremely important. I think, one, you got to have the athletic ability, but two, you got to have basketball insight too. So I think from our athletic ability, definitely having quickness and change of direction ability laterally, very, very important. But I think you can be quick. There's a big difference between change of direction ability and true agility, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if, you know, you're super familiar, but like if you can, you can be as fast as you want side to side, but if you don't know when the other person's going to move side to side, it don't matter, right? Mm-hmm. And so that comes with knowledge of the game and that inherent ability of understanding where someone else is going and how to move them and not let them move you. And that's something that's really cool to, in the team setting, you get to see all these different pieces come together. Some of it is developed in the weight room. Some of it's developed in other places. But a big piece of it is developed on the court during, you know, workouts, right? And with their skill and in their coaches. So I think that's a really neat piece to see both on Coach Larinaga's side, Coach Meyer's side with the women's team as well, is get to see how are these coaches kind of getting these players, one, who are, you know, very, very elite players, good physical athletic ability, and getting them to be able to learn how to perform at their best, how to stop a defender, all that type of stuff as a team, right? It's not a one man sport.
And then just to put a bow on this topic with basketball usage, playing ball, and then strength training, we had a Olympic high jumper enter into one of our higher higher end programs a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And as she entered in, she found out like right after that she had to have surgery for a partially torn soleus. And what we found out was probably the reason why was because she was doing too much plyometrics with like no strength training, weight training. And just the point I want to iterate here, and maybe you can add anything to it, is that like when you play basketball and or when you do high jump or things like that, while you are working your body and you are training your body and your body is getting sore, you're not strengthening the muscles. You're working the muscles. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there's definitely importance of laying down a foundation of strength on top of things. It helps you be better. One, be better at plyometric activity, be better at quickness, be better at jumping. But two, builds tendon health, builds the ability of your body to be more resilient when you do experience those high velocity type movements like jumping, running, sprinting. So having that foundational strength, very important. I agree.
And then your central focus beyond sports science is physical therapy, getting guys and women back as fast as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. Fast as possible and as best as possible.
And then what do you feel like the people that get back the fastest, what are they doing that some other people might not be?
I think there's definitely a mental component too, right? To at least to the speed of rehabilitation. You know, we have our parameters of tissue's only going to heal this quick no matter what we do. We'll do everything we can, you know, nutrition, rest, recovery, try to get you between sessions as recovered as you can. Sometimes that moves the needle a little bit. Sometimes it just doesn't from a research standpoint too, right? For ACL, there's some evidence that you don't want to come back too early, right? Or you're more at risk of re-tearing, right? So whenever we can move the needle, we move the needle. If we can't move the needle, we don't. But the people who do the best and move the fastest through, there's definitely a level of determination, some grit that you notice in them in terms of their approach. Doesn't mean they're not going to break down time to time, but they're the first people to jump back up, get back in the driver's seat, and start pushing forward again.
They're doing all the little things that you ask them to do, I'm guessing.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. And sometimes there's a fight. Sometimes there's questions about it, right? Mm-hmm. And questions are good. That helps them build an understanding of what's going on. It's something that I think I view as one of the most important parts of my job is helping them understand what's going on. It's sometimes a very new process, the first time they've had a big time loss period from their sport. Something takes away some of their identity too. So being able to connect with them, identify what their goals are, and then help build that in. And I think really bring the team around them helps them feel like, wow, I'm not distant from the team. I'm still a part of the team. You know, I'm not acting in the role that I want to act in right now, but I can still contribute. I'm still growing. I'm still developing. And it takes a lot of pieces of that for it to be done successfully.
And then Miami had the men's team. I think the women did too, but had great seasons last year, correct?
Yeah, phenomenal seasons last year. Men's team made it to the Final Four, women's team Elite Eight for the first time in program history for both teams.
And then do you have anything, what distinctly maybe outside physical attributes did you notice about those teams, those players that set them up to be so successful in the tournament?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we had a great pieces on the men's side, a lot of connection, a lot of leadership, I'd say, in the locker room too, and a lot of ability to bounce back when times were hard. So I think that was a real strength to the program last year. One of the real special things I remember, we had our first fall practice, and Coach L, he always has a quote of the day on our, in our practice plan, and the quote of the day was begin with the end in mind. And so he's talking about, all right, you know, where do we see this season going? And, you know, the guys all and he collectively were like, we're going to be ACC champs. And so it was cool that year to end the season, regular season champs, and see that kind of start to finish. And everything it took in between to get to that moment. And I think on the men's side, they do a lot of really cool stuff in terms of program values. They have 10 commitments, 10 five offensive, five defensive commitments that they recite every day that are really, really important to them. And so
building that culture
that Coach L is able to do. And Coach Meyer has a very similar approach too. And so they both, but unique to the women's team, you know, and what they need. And I think both their approaches fit their teams really well, fit their style really well, and fit their the kids that they recruit too. But that whole ability of seeing the end before you get there and striving for it and building towards it, I think was really something really special to be a part of.
And then how do I pronounce the coach's last name? Larinaga?
Larinaga for the men's time. And then, yeah, and then Coach Katie Meyer.
And Larinaga's been around forever. What makes him unique?
Yeah, unique. He's a great future Hall of Fame coach for sure. He done very well, had success in the past, previous Final Four before coming to Miami, and then really built Miami basketball. You know, Miami basketball wasn't a huge on the map thing until recently, even. But I would say his culture and consistently developing great relationships with the players, his ability to collectively pull from the staff. He's a very special leader, really different type of coach to be a part of, a real motivational person.
Why do you say that? Those things, special type of leader, different type of coach.
Yeah.
What comes to mind?
Well, he's special in practice. Like I've never seen a coach so positive and emphasize the positive so much. It's something that's really, really unique. You know, you've always, you know, heard of, you know, prior to working in high level athletics, that it's always going to be, you know, that high energy, in your face, yelling at you type person. And you know, all of our coaches need to be that at times. But his ability to just connect with players, his ability to lead from a different type of seat is something that's, I think it's just unique to be a part of a program like that.
And did you ever see Coach K get super pissed?
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. He's a different energy, right? Different coach, different culture.
So even in his last year.
Yeah, even in his last year. Definitely not as high octane as, you know, as he used to be, I think. Yeah. I've heard from hearing stories and stuff, but I think, you know, I definitely got to see the Coach K come out and the energy that he, you know, brought into that. I think part of it, you know, that last season meant a lot to that team and that and Duke as a whole, you know. So I think getting to see that and that energy come out is something that's, you know, you're like, whoa, I've been waiting to see this, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read a great book on him. It came out last year. I think it was by Ian O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, it's just the funniest stories in there in terms of, like, he would say he would strategically get pissed, but it just seems like he could. I mean, he comes from Bobby Knight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they had a kind of a tumultuous relationship. But, man, he has the funniest story in there where he was screaming at the players, and then he saw this garbage can, so he wanted to tip it over. And he couldn't tip it over because it was so heavy. And then finally he tipped it over and like one little water bottle rolled out. But he's intense.
He is.
And even in the last year he was intense.
Yeah, yeah. But also very, very has a great connection with his players too. You know, that was a special team to be a part of. Paolo Banchero, getting to see those guys play is just phenomenal, great athletes. But they you know, he respects his players and they respect him. And that's something I think is really, really special, even in that environment where you have a lot of energy, a lot of emotion, still holding respect of your players and you know, them respecting you is something I think extremely important in that high intense environment.
And then with the role that you play at Duke and then at the University of Miami, in terms of like day to day, what do you think about it that like causes uncertainty for you? Are you making sure that you're getting this right? Like what's kind of rolling through your mind in terms of the role that you have and making sure that you're doing it correctly?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, at Duke, it was nice to have, you know, people above you to learn under, right? So I work with their director of high performance and then with other teams at Duke as well, kind of with their staffs and support and getting to learn and grow. But then here at Miami, you know, it's a little bit more weight in terms of making sure everything goes well and everything goes smoothly. So I think from the rehabilitation side, it's always checking yourself in terms of, are we hitting the goals that we want to set? Are we including everybody on the team and not missing any pieces for this athlete? That's something we got to always take a step back, take a bird's eye view at, and make sure that we're not just one, putting the cart before the horse, doing things we're not ready for yet. But two, making sure we're also including, you know, the skill coaches immediately as soon as they can be included working out a player. We're not delaying that, just being like, oh, they're ready, but we were holding back a little bit too. So something that we do is we write out the programming and then everybody's included on that. We meet daily in terms of our team's approach for that player.
Mm-hmm.
During our practice plan meeting, we give updates onto the coaching staff. Hey, this person's going to be in for this, out for this. And as they're building back into their practice activity, I think that's one of the key components where we're always taking another look at it, trying to change directions in terms of how we're viewing the problem, getting them back. It's not a problem, but it's an opportunity. And so figuring out the best solution for getting them back into team activity, while making sure they can move well, they have a good understanding of the plays that they're getting into. You know, a lot of times when a player is getting back, we consider the physical aspect. All right, you're strong enough. You've passed your return to play testing, or you're able to, you know, output good ability on force plates. That's all great. But then they have to go back and learn how to do their sport again. And they may have been out for an extended period of time. And so how do we build that skill step by step? And sometimes the best person to do that is one of the coaches. And so incorporating them in the rehabilitation process is really, really important for us.
And then what are some things you do to build relationship with the athletes so they get buy-in from you?
Yeah.
Or you get buy-in from them?
One, we have a great time. We try to make it as engaging and fun as possible. It's one of the most sucky times of your life, you know, when you get out and you can't play for an extended period of time. And so
that's awesome.
Yeah, we try to make it fun. We have a great time. We try to, for the most part, try to work while the team's working. That's something that's been a big part of the culture of our women's team for sure, is like when the team's working, you're working too. And so it gives everybody a vision of we're working together. We're not, you didn't finish rehab and now you're sitting on the sidelines. You're part of the team. You get to work. You're not an observer. You're an active member of the team. And so that's something top down, I think, has really been a positive impact on the players. Two, always setting what the goal is and what the next step. So it's not like we're working blindly and the athletes just coming in daily and understanding what they have an idea of where the target is. It doesn't have to be the long-term target. Everybody knows the long-term target is to get back playing and looking great out there, and, you know, get the opportunity to be a contributor again. But we look even before that, what is the next step? What is your next goal? What is your next goal? What can you hit today that's going to help you tomorrow? And I think that is a big factor that helps do that. And then another thing is we'll use objective measures to do that. So we want to see this on this testing. We want to see you hit this on your biodex strength test for your knee. We want to see you hit this on your force plates. I want to see you hit this when you're shooting off the gun. Like, you got to hit this percentage and that's the target, right? So it's kind of a holistic approach of what are ways we can give them incentives and ways to push the needle. Just on the daily basis, it doesn't feel like we're just shooting towards this endless target and I don't really know where I am from here to the finish line.
Yeah, the brain is so goal-focused. If you could bring them back to today,
yeah,
then be able to – yeah, that's tough. But, man, if you can, do you have any specific stories that have just been really fun or inspiring that in terms of people getting injured and coming back?
Yeah, definitely. We have had a couple instances for sure. One of them, you know, strength – was coming slowly. Like, it's strength, you know, weight room is not, like you said, not always the ideal favorite thing for a basketball player to do. And somebody who doesn't love the weight room, doesn't love lifting, it can be a challenge, especially when you got to come back from an injury. So I think one of the instances we were having a athlete biodex test, which was a knee strength assessment that we use a lot of times after ACL rehab. It's an isokinetic test that lets you understand the ability for the quad and hamstrings to output force at different velocities, different speeds, but it's kind of one of the gold standard tests for getting an athlete back to play. And we incorporated the coach into that. We said, hey, we're at this. And that was a good way to kind of get the athlete motivated, one, and then have like a cheering squad on the side too. And so having coach call him afterwards, hey, great job on this. I see what you're doing. I see your work. Is something I think that really helps athletes who maybe really came here for the relationship with coach, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to be like, oh, they're checked into me, even though I'm not currently active on the team. So I think that was a real special thing to see, and just be like super excited after, you know, making even a little bit of progress, because coach is going to call them right after that and just be like, hey, keep working, keep going. Other instances, I think for me, you know, always special when you see an athlete get back on the court the first time, mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't look great and it's kind of a little bit clunky at first, but it's just something special. I think that's something I really try to do with a couple of our athletes is we video a lot throughout the process. One, for me, because it helps me see what is your, you know, joint angle when you're moving in this kind of plane. How do you look when you're doing a squat? How do you look when you're lunging? How do you look when you're doing a lateral slide? But then the best thing to do is look back at that and show the athlete, look what you look like 2 weeks ago. All right, look mm-hmm. what you look like now. Do you see the difference? And they, boom, something clicks in their head and they're like, wow, I don't look like the same person I look like a couple weeks ago. And so I think video and visual ability to show an athlete what they look like before And not everybody is visual in terms of what, how they take information, but a lot of our players are. That's what makes them really, really good. And so being able to show them changes over time visually, I think, is something that really, really connects with them.
Yeah. And then what specifically do you guys do to help guys get lower? I know if they have such long levers.
Oh, yeah.
Low man, in a lot of sports, low man wins. Is there anything specifically you guys do that help with that?
Yeah. So
hip mobility, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. So you got to have motion first. If you don't have hip mobility to do it, you're not going to get there because you don't have the motion to get there. But then strength in a low base is important too. And so during our preseason training, we'll do a lot of work in that kind of those kind of positions. A lot of sled drag work. We do more extended time work in those kind of positions too, staying low, moving low. And then in the rehab side of things, that's extremely important too. And one of the things that you probably don't want to do a lot, especially after a knee injury, your body doesn't want to be in that position and like standing up straight, right? It feels a lot better to stand up straight than it is to get down and things. So, you got to build the ability and the capacity and strength to be in that position. But then we'll do a lot of work while we're just, maintaining those positions, getting them into those positions. And one of the real cool special things we have is we have, it's called Cane Sense. It's a couple IMU sensors that go on the knee. And we always preseason test our athletes and we'll test them against serially throughout the year if they had an issue, with like a lateral slide and some basketball specific movements. And it gives us information on what their actual motion excursion is, from like knee joint angle. And their ability in, with a change of direction, how low do they stay? How is it symmetrical side to side? And then another piece that we use for athletes coming back to play.
Maybe you could help me with this. I need to stretch my hips more than I do. I feel like one of the big reason, well, this might just be excused, but the reason that I don't as much as I need to is like I have a hard time measuring it. Like my hips getting more flexible or mobile.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice you could give me on that in terms of what I could do that like could be like a metric or a...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can just use range of motion for sure. Right? Okay. You break out, they have little goniometers, right? People can measure your hip range. But functionally, I think is a nice, more easy way to do it, more adaptable way to do it. You can do that with a couple different things. You can look at squat depth. You can look at your ability to get into a lower squat. Now, that might not just be a range of motion issue. Could be something else, right? But that's something that can be used. A lot of stuff that we like to do is some cars. I don't know if you've done hip cars before, but it involves like kind of rocking back and forth, moving. Mm-hmm. That's controlled articular movements of the hip, and the ability to be able to see, oh, I can rock this far now, I can move this far into hip external rotation, hip internal rotation. That can help you kind of get an idea of just visually real quickly, oh, I've made a little bit of progress, my hips are feel a little bit tighter now, they're not. That's a nice easy way to look at things too. And then the ability, I think another piece is having, well, you might have motion, having end range control too. So do you have the ability to control your strength at those end ranges, lift off, be able to control muscle? You know, it's usually going to be weaker at your end ranges of motion, just because of lever arm and your ability to contract in those positions. So working on like strengthening in those end ranges can be something that helps, while you might have mobility, give you control in those positions too.
And then with the hips, there's the hip flexor, which I hear about all the time, hip flexor stretch. But then in my work, when I was doing track, a big thing was the hip extensor that you wanted to strengthen because that helped get your foot back in front of you so you could take the next stride. Are there any specific stretches for that you recommend? I haven't heard that much about when people talk about hip extensor and mobility.
Well, hip extension ability is really important from an acceleration ability, an ability to reach top speeds and move at top speeds, having that range of motion. And so mobility work for the hip flexor, really important. Strength work for the posterior hip, really important.
Okay.
So, but it is important to have a strong hip flexor too, you know, so you're not in the position where you're necessarily too weak in the hip flexor, maybe having a hip flexor strain from overstretching, those type of positions too. But kind of name of the game, usually really, really building a strong posterior chain, strong ability to extend the hip forcefully, powerfully. And it is a kind of your muscular power point, right? And then having the ability to move into those positions, get into that hip extension, mobility wise from like the front of the hip flexors. Yeah.
And you have a favorite hip flexor stretch that you recommend or hip stretch?
Yeah, I love hip stretching when you're using other muscular contraction too. So we'll do like a hip flexor stretch, you know, your typical kneeling one where you've got one knee on the ground, one knee forward. And instead of just rocking into it all day long and stretching out the hip flexor and then getting into your low back and kind of extending up from there, really work on squeezing your posterior chain while you do it. So you're kind of mimicking that motion that you're, one, activating like you would be in a sprint or a run or anything like that. So you're squeezing your hip muscles, like your glutes as you're doing it, and then rocking forward. You feel a lot more stretch in the front of the hip, but it's also going to be a little bit more controlled in terms of what the type of movement it is. It's not just rolling through the rest of the motion that you have, kind of locks it out and gets a better stretch.
That's great. And I got a question about my older son. I've been training them since they were like 2.
Yeah.
So I'm very proud in terms of how balanced they are in terms of athletically, in terms of different attributes they have.
Yeah.
But I got to take accountability on this because he's had this since he was probably like 7 or 8. So I'm guessing it's something that I did in terms of how I was working him. But he has a hard time getting his knee up when he's accelerating. Basketball, you don't even get, he's a huge basketball player. So you're not even getting like top speed.
Yeah.
But it just looks like it's a lot to get the leg up as high. You think the hip flexor is weak or is something overworked?
I think it could possibly be weakness, right? But some of it is also just movement, coordination, and ability too. How old is he?
He's now 14.
14, yeah. So probably maybe could be either. But I think, one, you can do some stuff strengthening the hip flexor. One of the cool things I like to do is I'll do skipping and stuff with band work. So you can put a band around the feet. Really work on driving that knee up during the skip. Skipping and jumping is a nice component to build into that explosive takeoff type position, right, where they're driving up the knee. The other thing is just giving cues and filming it and kind of going back through it. You know, I'm not a track guy primarily, so it's definitely not my area of expertise, I'd say, but I'm giving cues and external cues on what that you want that movement to look like, as opposed to just telling him, hey, get your knee higher. Giving him some target cues can be really helpful. So like imagine, like use analogy, imagine you're breaking glass as you drive your knee forward. Imagine it's driving through the ceiling. Those type of motion things usually connect with the athlete better, and using those external type driven cues usually have more success than if you're giving a cue. It's like, I want you to squeeze your hip flexor as you come up, right?
Yeah.
That just doesn't usually work as well as giving an athlete a target cue or something that's like a little more externally focused.
And then I saw that you're familiar with P3, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
They're considered best of the best or amongst the best in terms of basketball performance. Well, I saw a really interesting article from their CEO last year, who said that lateral forces now they correlate better to basketball success rather than vertical jump.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that as well? And then what do you guys do to improve lateral forces?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's really interesting stuff. And we've had a couple athletes come in from them with some really cool information and data that we've been able to look over with them too. I think lateral force is a real hard thing to measure. You know, the nice thing about having force plates, having ability to kind of measure things into the ground is your typical assessments are more vertically driven. You know, most of the force plates on the market that you'll see from like Hawk and Dynamics, Vald, those are usually force plates that just get vertical ground reaction force. So it's only the force going you put vertically into the plate that it measures. It's kind of like a really, really fancy bathroom scale, right? Where force plates in a lab, you might see, they might get movement in all three planes. So if you step on the force plate laterally, it'll show you that it's measuring that force laterally, not just the vertical component of that force, right? So if you have the tech to do that and really, really great ability to measure in those, now most of the force is still going to be vertical, just because of how you hit the ground and you're coming from top down too. But it is really cool that if you have the opportunity to look at those forces in multiplanar movements, and have force plates with that type of technology, a lot more expensive, a lot less portable, usually in the lab setting. But those are, you know, really cool to look at. From us measuring lateral, we do some bounding and hopping type stuff laterally and measure. I wouldn't say it's the best yet. I think it's really cool. It's kind of seeing some of the research that they're doing and stuff they're coming out with. But it definitely gives us some really cool stuff to try to chase and give us some idea of stuff we could be looking at as well.
Yeah, it seems like they do a ton of ice skaters, and that's what they're. Is that how they're measuring with those plates?
Yeah, yeah. I think you do like a lateral bound type movements and stuff. Yeah, that's kind of what we've explored and played with a little bit. It's a little bit harder when you don't have them built into the ground always, too, because you don't want somebody just turn their ankle because they missed the plate. You know, plates are about this big, so giving an idea of where they're going to land and giving them a target versus maximally pushing off too. Like, so we've played with a couple of different ways to do it. Hawkins got a couple of tests that you can do and play with stuff too. And another, you can also just free run and kind of play around with the plates too. But yeah, I think vertical ability or lateral ability is something that's extremely important in the process. And, a big part of how we train, but it's cool to build in ways to assess that too. And I think really, really important.
Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit here. Let's say you have a mid-30s like business professional that comes to you and says, hey, I want to get the strongest, leanest, most jacked I've ever been, and you have access to all the tools that you have now.
Yeah.
And then you say, hey, how committed are you to doing this? And he says, 10 out of 10. What are some of the tools that you would use to monitor and get him on his way.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I wish we had that even with athletes, right? Like, you have a limited amount of time with people, right? And sometimes, you know, different things pulling them in different directions. But yeah, you say you had the perfect world, somebody interested in all this stuff. There's a lot of things you could do. I think, one, you got to narrow those goals, figure out what exactly is that mean to them. What does strong mean to them? Does it mean faster? Does it mean explosive? Does it mean, you know, putting on a lot of muscle, right? I think that is one of the big things, and that'll really direct you a little bit more in terms of what tools you can use, right? Say it's an athlete who wants to get more explosive, or a business professional wants to get more explosive, more fast. Maybe they do some stuff, they're a weekend warrior, do a little bit on the weekends, right? And play ball, right? I think, one, you want to first identify what their training history has been in the past. You know, are they just starting from zero? Are we have a good training age on them first, building from there? And then from tools, I think you really have to see what they feel like they're good at. What do they need too? If they're somebody who does, hey, I'm already doing pretty good on the strength side, or I'm doing all right in this, but I'm not sleeping well, then it looks a whole different picture of, you know, I feel like I get good rest and I'm pretty good, but I may not be doing the activity side of things or the training side as well too. So I think those are two different routes I might have to go to. Knowing what you want, being specific, having the tech not be the solution, but a piece of how to get to the solution, I think is really important for us. Like, we never usually start with the tech. We always start with what is the performance problem, and then do we have tech here, or can we figure out a solution to how to answer it, involving tech or not involving tech, that helps us come to a good, happy solution that is the best way we can answer the problem.
And these performance teams at like Duke or University of Miami, these different, it's not the tech, but it's what are the different components for all of them? So there's the nutrition, there's the skill itself, there's the training, sleep and recovery. Is that something that's who communicates that to players?
I think it just depends on the setting, right? Okay. So for some teams, they're taking daily questionnaires from guys. Some teams use products like the Oura Ring or something where it's tracking the player's sleep, right? And that's a whole different question and component of getting people to do that, right? And be consistent and be reliable, because unreliable data is just as bad as no data, or even worse sometimes, because you start pulling off of stuff that's not real, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the challenge in all these, is you not only need data, you need good data, and then you have to have somebody or a team, really ideally a team of people who are looking together to find the best solution. Because even when you have some information that shows you, hey, so-and-so doesn't sleep well, all right, what do you do about it then? Why do you move forward with that information and make an impact? Because some things you can change, some things are a lot harder to change than just saying, hey, go to sleep earlier, right? That just doesn't work usually, right? So finding especially behavioral type solutions is a challenge, right? It's not just something that happens overnight. It's somebody's built habits, right, in terms of how they do things. So I think, you know, when it gets into those type of situations, it's a lot different than, oh, we're going to modify training load for tomorrow because we had a high week, right, you know?
Yeah, and then how do you look at, like, the Oura Ring? So, like, with us, we give our clients Oura Rings, and then what I've seen is the data is not like, it's not that exact. So what the way we kind of like to measure it is like, as long, it seems like it's a really good tool of what's trending. Like the stuff that you're doing now and your scores are trending up, that's good. If they're trending down, then we need to make some adjustments. Yeah. How confident are you with the data that you see on that?
Yeah, yeah. Our women's team has been doing that through a external company, own it, and that's been kind of cool to see a little bit of what they do. We did some partnership with that in terms of more, not necessarily data that we're gonna look at entirely, because one, it's not probably gonna be the most reliable, because I can't enforce you to put it on right before you go to sleep every night, and unless we get extreme amount of buy-in, and Eric talked about some of the guys at their program opt out, I'm not doing that, right? Mm-hmm. And some guys opt in, say, oh, this is really important to me. So if we have people that bought in, yes, it's been helpful. It's been really good. You have players that this is less of important to me. I'm not gonna wear it. I'm not gonna charge it. I gotta, it's on me. Everything in the facility, we do a very, very good job at. Very, very good job of clipping it, collecting it, having a high fidelity to the data. It is what it is. It's very accurate. It's very collected in a really accurate way. It's taken care of. It's cleaned. Then you have data that's on the player, right? And these type of solutions where people are wearing rings, other devices that they take out of the facility, it gets a lot bumpier. So some of the stuff we try to look at, like you said, more trends over time. How does things look over time? How are they using it? One, you can use a device to just give you information. One, you can use a device where you may be looking to make a change. And this device gives you information that helps you make that decision, right? So like, hey, I don't feel like I sleep well. I've been wearing the ring. And I realize that I don't go to bed that early anymore, right? So like, that's something that's cool. So time of sleep is something we'll look at. HRV will look at just over time like that too. It's not as quick and easy to act off of like what Eric's working with football. That's very granular, really, really good data. When you're looking at stuff where it's a little bit more on the athlete and it's a PPG sensor and it's a little bit harder, it's a little bit less like, oh, we can look at what they were doing during this meeting, right? We can't do that necessarily very accurately. So I would say, yeah, I'd agree. Trend over time, looking at how you can change habits is the big thing too. So again, associating, when I do these things, I feel better. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm more prepared, and making habit changes, I think, is where those tools that you have, Apple Watches or Ring, Whoop Bands, those can be a helpful piece for you, in terms of making habit changes. Another thing is tracking activity, right? So they're grossly good at that too, right? And so for just the everyday person who really wants to see, what am I doing? What am I wanting to build on? What are my activity goals? What do I want to do more of? It can be a nice way to plot that over time, see it, be interested in it, be engaged with it, and kind of interact with the information too.
And in terms of, I forgot what I had something really good that I wanted to ask about that Aura ring. Okay. And then here's where I was going to go. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Optimal cognitive functioning. We get a lot of questions here of like, there's so many different perspectives on the internet. Like so many people say this about is the best training method. So many people say this is the best fitness method. I don't know who to listen to. And then my answer is always the same, is always to, I think you got to reframe what's going on. I think that we live in a very special time in human history. Where like for the first time ever, like it's legal in almost every state. You don't even need a third party. You can order and have a blood test done in your house. You can get a biometric wearable. You can, what still happens with athletes now, even with all this tech, is one of the things, how are you feeling? How did you sleep last night? How much energy you have? Is really, we have an opportunity to take advantage of all of these tools and this information to gain awareness on our body. So we can really decide for ourselves on what really works best for us. Do you agree with that? And do you have anything that potentially you think could add on to someone who says, who the fuck am I supposed to listen to?
Saying, no, it is a very unique time. Like everything is so accessible. Information's accessible. And health information is more accessible too, right? Like what does that mean for me? And I think one, it can be scary and dangerous at the same time, right? You have so much that's accessible to you, so much and being able to narrow down what's important for me to act on and what can I act on is a challenge too. So I think
you know, personally for me, like I track my own sleep. I track stuff, you know, I have a newborn, not newborn now, but a couple months now. And so it's been a little bit of like, all right, I'm not going to wear the Oura Ring anymore. Yeah. It's just going to make me mad. Right.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think there's definitely opportunity to one, do have a little bit of, performance optimization of your life as opposed to just framed just for the athlete too, right? So maybe you're just in a workplace and you want to be better at work, right? You want to be better at improving your focus, your attention, your ability to be physically fit, right? There's a lot of opportunities to do that with everything out there that's accessible. I think one of the challenges, there's not a good place to just look and say, oh, this has got all the good information. Everybody's got a little bit of piece of great stuff. And a lot of times there's not a whole lot that's novel. I would say even with everything that's out there, a lot of things are being done and then being done again in a slightly different twist. Somebody calls it something else. Somebody does something different. And so taking a step back and not being overwhelmed that, you know, sometimes the foundational stuff works well. And usually the best program is the program that you're going to do. And so working into doing that first and making a step in action towards it. And then if it's not working for you, adjust it and move on.
Yeah. I love what you did by tossing the Oura Ring for a little bit. Cause that's the central theme of what we're doing here at Super Athlete is like, we want to be relentless in providing the tools that you can have to help you optimize your body, your energy, your mood, your hormones, your nutrition, all that stuff. And then on the other side of that is we want you to be able to dominate no matter when that shit all goes wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's sideways. And then, so with that, do you have any specific thoughts on how people should kind of view this data in terms of how it impacts their day-to-day and how they should view it in a way that's most optimal for them?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big things a lot of these devices have is like a strain score, right? Or they'll even tell you when to work out, not to work out. And so one of the things that I always tell our athletes right off the bat is like, all right, don't listen to that. Like, we, you know, we might prep practice today still. So if your Oura Ring said you shouldn't do activity today, don't tell coach that I told you that, right?
I'm sure Coach K would be very receptive.
Yeah. Any of the coaches, right? It doesn't matter which coach. So I think, one of the things we do with that is be mindful that the device, that's an algorithm, right? Telling you what to do, right? So being mindful of that, look at the trends, look at the raw information if you can, and have the ability to do that a little bit more. And then at the end of the day, you know, when we get like, I think we always think about it for us, like postseason is the most important, right? You got to have a good season to get there. You got to have a good, all that first, but, postseason is going to be draining, right? It's not going to be I ask them their rate of perceived exertion. Nobody's going to say, oh, I feel pretty good. I feel light, right? Everybody's going to be fatigued, right? And that's across the board. That's every team that's competing, right? Everyone may be doing a little bit job sleeping, a little bit job recovering and trying to, you know, have that edge. But at the end of the day, you got to go out and compete. And so I think, something that I've, gained a good perspective on, I was talking to, a couple Army guys and talking about how, well, yeah, we want to optimize performance. We want to do all that for our guys too. But at the end of the day, grit and resilience is something that's an important aspect too. And so I think, you know, we can do all these things and have these pieces put in too, but at the end of the day, you got to go out there, step on the court and play, and having that resilience and ability to push through and fatigue and all that and play. You know, you have your Jordan flu games, you have some of the best performances of history when guys don't feel good and their Oura Ring probably told them they couldn't go out and play. So
yeah,
it's a balance of having those things and putting people in the best position, and then also building a good and strong mentality of this is the type of program we are, this is the type of people that we want to build too.
Yeah. Competitive greatness. I love that.
Yeah. And some of that, you know, I feel like it can be learned, but some of it, it feels like it's a little inherent too, to just the personality type, the person, right? So I think that's some really interesting stuff that, you know, you want to make an impact on people with, you know, even if it's in the rehab process. Grit and resilience for us is extremely important for, kind of making it to the finish line and getting back.
Yeah. I agree with you that it's probably part genetic and part learned, but just understand that it's a valuable skill
in any
competitive arena to be able to have those things in competitiveness. Yeah, there's a sports scientist named Clive Brewer.
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar with Clive?
I know Clive, yeah.
Okay. He was on the show a couple months ago, and he talked about when he was with the – his track record's crazy. I mean, yeah, I know he's a sports scientist, so he like –
Clive's done a ton, right?
Yeah, and he, like every team he's gone on, they've gone to the playoffs. So yeah, I'm like, what? And he was proud of that too. So yeah, like he should be. Yeah. But he was talking about when he was with the Blue Jays, they would have the Aura Ring, and the pitchers, when they would pitch that night, like they would come up to him and they'd be like, "Hey, Clive, my Aura Ring says I'm at like a 50. You think I should pitch tonight?" And like, it was just this fuck it mentality of like, I don't care what this says. I want to go out and do what I do.
Yeah.
So I think that's like, it's just finding that balance and using that. I just cross my score out sometimes. I'll just cross it out and put something else on there.
Yeah.
That's like just the mental frame. You got to find what works to use that. And again, I just think the trends piece is where to really to look at that. Okay. And then with your time working with these high level programs, is there anything specific that you've noticed with the best players that they all kind of share, or the majority of them you've noticed that they've shared in terms of traits or attributes outside of, you know, physical skills and genetics and things like that?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think everybody's different too. I think that's one of the unique makeups of college athletics, is everybody's coming from a different background. Everybody's got different experiences that make them who they are. But I think one of the uniting factors that I've seen is a confidence, right? If you're at that level, you have to have some type of confidence that is a little bit unshakable. You know, guys that you're not going to hit every shot. But your ability to just go out there and be like, yeah, I'm making the next one, and take the same shot over and over again and make it, you know, to me, sometimes I'm like, man, I wouldn't have taken that shot, right? But just the internal confidence that's going in is absolutely, you know, insane to watch sometimes, you know. I think that's definitely a piece, and just a little bit of unshakable confidence. Some level, like we talked about, of resilience or grit to be able to go out and do it over and over and over again. And then I think, you know, you got to enjoy what you do too. I think the players that are the most successful and the most engaged, enjoy it. They love it. Like it's not a work for them. It's not a second job. It's their favorite thing to do, you know? So all these other pieces sometimes, and that sometimes can be the hard part, is like, how do you get them to enjoy the strength side? How do you get them to enjoy this? They love basketball. But framing them all as pieces that help them do that better. And help them be better at basketball, help them be available. You know, the best ability is availability. So if we're keeping them there, then, you know, that helps them be engaged in it, engaged in the process.
Three things. So you said you got to love it. The first one really resonated with me, which we haven't heard yet when we've asked this question. It's the unshakable confidence, to have kind of a disproportionate confidence. And what was the second one?
Oh,
grit and resiliency.
Grit and resiliency, and then just love of it, like the love of the game, love of whatever they're doing. It's got to be, you know, you have to have that desire to master it, you know, that desire for mastery of what you do.
And it seems like those three things go together.
I think they do. Yeah. I think they go really well. And I think that's not just applicable to basketball, right? That's applicable to any activity. You know, if you're PT, you know, you love it, you want to get better at it. You're a strength coach, get better at it. Like all those pieces come together really well. I think for multiple things.
Okay. And then we talked about this earlier, but just, I want to get it with a clarity, because I think it's super, because it's pretty rare in terms of like your experience, both places you've been on the men's side, they have Hall of Fame level coaches. What's the number one thing that stood out to you about Coach Krzyzewski, Coach K, that was like, wow, this guy's great?
I think just the culture that he built with the culture of excellence, you know, within the team is just really, really special. I think you can call on a lot of things that make him who he is and what he's been able to accomplish, but just the culture of discipline, the culture of respect within the team, and how everyone kind of walks and carries those values, I think is something that's very special. He's also someone that, you know, the guys are still part of that brotherhood, right?
Yeah.
Like, so the Duke brotherhood. Yeah, yeah. They call that. That's something that's like very, very palpable when you're there. You know, you have a good idea who the brotherhood is, what that means, and what it's what that
you know, entails being part of as the guys that are on the team, you know? And so being able to outside, even when you're on the staff outside looking in, see that and what he's built with those guys, I think is very, very special. So just the ability to build culture, and maintain it longitudinally over time, you know, that's challenging. Mm. And so I think just being able to build that and, you know, some success oftentimes breeds success, but there's periods when it's not successful, and to be able to maintain that culture, I think is really special.
And then number one thing in terms of Jim Larranega, in terms of Hall of Fame coach, takeaway from him, that
Coach L, so you know, usually you would think a coach that's been around for a long time adapting to a new, you know, a lot of new stuff that we brought with us to the team, you know, and with, in bringing in sports tech, some in sports science within the team, you'd think it would be like a little foreign, right? And not be, you know, interested in using a whole lot of, right? And so for me, like, it surprised me at how innovative he is as a coach who's been in the game for a long time. You know, he's always looking for new solutions to answer problems, and he does a great job of finding and having a good basis foundation of what everyone's roles are on the team. And so he's able to piece those solutions together with the information provided to him, and it's not, didn't take a whole lot of work. Like, that yeah. surprised me. I thought, oh, we're going to bring in the stuff. We're going to have external load monitoring consistently. We're going to add, you know, athlete profiling stuff a little bit more. And his ability to adapt to it, take information in and work with it is like very, very impressive. You know, he uses it as a feedback tool in practices, how we change practices, how we modify. And for him to be able to just like, you give him information and he works with it is like really surprised me, like in terms of how effective he was able to just quickly like integrate it into their system. So I think he does that really well. I think the other thing is just his connection with the players. Like, he has a very positive culture of the team, like I said, and being able to maintain that with the team is special on his side.
Yeah, it reminds me of Nick Saban. Saban seemed like he was the same way in terms of being an old school coach, but just being completely open and adaptable about
whatever. Yeah, and they've used that stuff well too. You know, yeah. I've heard, you know, watched a couple of things about him talking about how they integrated some of the wearable stuff in Alabama football too. And you know, it's cool to see coaches that have lived through generations of what the game looks like and how it's being, how support staffs around the team are working with them. And it's cool to see them adapt, you know, quickly integrated into their style, integrated into how it works. But I think at the end of the day, he does a good job of integrating it into how it answers team questions too. So in those core values, so like within three of those 10 commitments I referenced, like three of them have the word run in them. And so running is extremely important to, you know, our team and the ability to run for layups and open threes, run and get back on defense. Those things are really important. And so one of the metrics that we look at consistently is like distance covered at a high intensity. And the ability to, you know, it's not sprint distance because it's not open field. You know, we don't really ever reach a huge, huge top speed in a basketball court. But but that, and then the percentage of distance that we're covering at that high speed. Are we covering most of the time, or are we like jogging back and then hitting some, you know, good top speed runs too? And so that's something that we'll look at granularly or just as a whole in a game too, is what does that look like for us? You know, we're a good fast break team in the past, you know, so I think that's something that's really cool for him, and he loves seeing is that ability to, you know, move at a high speed and consistently, you know, a value that's instilled in his program, be able to have a quantifiable outlook on that too.
Which is part of their culture.
Which is part of their culture, yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff. All right, Tom, we're going to end here on some rapid fire.
Yeah.
Best book or research paper you've read in the past year?
Best book? I love Mastery by Robert Greene. Okay. I think that's something I've been, you know, have dove into. I reread it and reread it and re-listen to it.
That's my favorite Robert Greene book,
too. Yeah, absolutely. So just ability to kind of develop mastery in a certain subject area, you know, and continue to grow and develop. I think for me, it really helps me return to it. And go, oh, well, I felt like I grew. Now I need to grow more. How do I, you know, harness the people around me's abilities to make me better too?
And then in terms of, to follow up to that question, where is your brain right now, or what are you kind of focusing on and putting your attention to in terms of improving and growing?
Yeah. So I'm really, one of the big things that we're working on, you know, and I'm trying to continue to understand better is for our ACL rehab stuff is arthrogenic muscle inhibition. And so that's a big thing for the, in layman's terms, your quad shuts down after you have ACL surgery, doesn't want to come back, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that consistently is a huge problem, you know, in terms of your typical graft types. If you have a patellar tendon graft or a quad tendon graft, you see that muscle inhibition for an extended period of time. And a lot of times people will say, ah, they're not strong enough. They didn't get strong enough. Well, they're trying, they're training hard. The muscle's just not taking, right? Almost, you know, so
far.
Yeah. So giving that, so trying to delve deeper into ways that we can decrease that in the rehab process, build strength, and diminish inhibition is something I'm really trying to dive in, read a lot of, get better at. There's some cool stuff on icing pre, muscle activation, using neuromuscular stim. Some really cool options in terms of how you can kind of get it firing at first. But I think that's something that once oftentimes we get the quad going after surgery, we forget about the inhibition part and we just go to strengthening. When the inhibition part didn't go away entirely, it's still there a little bit. So how do we kind of continue to look at that in the rehab process and build from there?
And then biggest mentor you've had in your life?
Biggest mentor I've had in my life. That's a great question. My dad, for sure. I would say, he, one, laid a tremendous impact on me and my ability to connect with people and talk with people. He worked for Dale Carnegie for a long time, if you know, familiar with how to win friends and influence people. Yeah, so he was with them for like 30 years. So, you know, brought me along, you know, he taught me, you know, you got to talk to everybody you see, get connect with them, build that, build relationships. And then, you know, also instilled a lot of those Carnegie values in me in terms of what, you know, what is the most important things that you do to connect with people, you know, remembering people's names, you know, how to do that, when to do it, why to do it. Finding out what's important to them, creating win-win situations with people, you know, and those types of ways to connect and build a relationship, build it within an organization too. So I think, you know, one, made an impact on me, obviously, is my dad, but two, like really just catapulted my ability to connect with people, try to grow personal and interpersonal relationships.
And then Carnegie was pretty relentless about positivity and optimism.
Absolutely. So the culture works really well for me. I feel like it was like coming home a little bit, you know, working with Coach L in terms of how he's built his culture within the team. You know, he on the weekends, they don't read the 10 commitments from a basketball standpoint. They go over the 7 habits of highly effective people with Stephen Covey. So like the team's out there reading them, you know, on the sideline. So it's kind of cool to have those similar like things that were instilled in me as a kid and growing up, and then be able to see that in the environment that I'm working in now too.
That's beautiful, man. That's so awesome. And then last question, biggest habit that you've, or just habit that you've added to your life that's had the, or taken away that's had the biggest impact in the past year?
Yeah. Great question. Biggest habit, definitely phone usage. I think I still chasing a better relationship with technology. Like I'm somebody who always wants, everybody, right? But like I'm trying to read and learn, right? So like almost constantly I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Read. So I'm reading all day long. But then learning how to shut that off is something that's been, you know, sometimes I don't do it great every time, but it's definitely when I do it well, I do better. So like, you know, before I go to bed, phone's off, no screens, being present, being in relationship, you know, everything at home. And then also just for sleep purposes too, I think I've done a whole lot better when I do put that away, despite even having a kid, right? I feel like, you know, if I left the screens alone, I have to get up a couple of times, a lot better still than if I'm like, oh, I got up now, I'm gonna read for a couple of, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours go by, oh shoot, you know, losing sleep. So I think that has been a big impact on sleep, is learning when to shut off and learn when to put things away, and then just, you know, set goals for tomorrow. So I'll write down, hey, these are the 3 things I looked at that I want to read tomorrow. Let me just, I'll see them in the morning. I'll do that, and being able to shut things off a little bit.
That's a skill.
Yeah.
That's a super skill.
It doesn't always go well.
Yeah. Tommy, appreciate you. And then best places for people to connect with you on social media.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Tommy_Otley_DPT. Same on X. LinkedIn, I think, is the same too. So anywhere like that, there should be other contact. And then always looking up on University of Miami website. It's got my email and everything there too.
Awesome. Tommy, thank you so much for coming on Super Athlete Radio.
Appreciate it.